This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 743, I think. If I've got the right number on top of the script. All is well. It's been a fascinating week. It has just been a very, very interesting week. So yeah, I'm going to readjust this just a little bit because it's kind of far back there. So, work, we were making our final preparations here for the big database move, trying to get a few things under control. We got all those things under control, making our big move this weekend. So like 6 o'clock tomorrow, they put up all the maintenance pages. The database people get started on backups and restores. Gonna take them all night to get that stuff done. And then starting Saturday morning at like 7, everybody starts changing connection strings. Now, I mean, for me, I'm already booked Saturday morning with breakfast for a friend and swing by Walmart. So, you know, I've told them I'll try to be in pocket by about 10. I may work some Friday night, getting ahead a little bit and kind of get that done so that I don't have so much to do on Saturday. But I'll be doing final testing on a couple of the major things and just following up and making sure that everything's okay, and then we'll open back up, hopefully. It's mostly just changing connection strings, so there's not, you know, it's not like we're deploying all new applications. We're just moving the back-end server. Usually these things go pretty smoothly, but there's always the chance. We are bouncing forward from version 2016 of SQL Server, our database engine, up to 2022. But we did testing all through May. It all seems to be fine. You know, we hit all the high points, and so everything seems like it's okay. And usually when you're bouncing up versions of a database server, it's usually better because those guys are very detailed oriented. They have to be. Data is king. Data is king. Everything is the data. And so usually the people who are data people, they are not rocket scientists. You know, they are careful, careful, careful. So usually it's okay. We did find one oddity bouncing from 2016 to 2022, but we've dealt with that. And it was just one of those weird things that I'm staring at it and telling the guys that should not have ever worked in the first place, you know. And so we modified it to where it worked the way it was supposed to work, so it was good. So that was fine. Work is good. Writing is good. I think I'm on track to get book 18 finished up. I finished my read-through, my final read-through. I'm starting to lay out all the pages now. So that's good. Gonna try to get that done. Probably try to get through it this weekend. If I can get through it this weekend, that'll be good. And so, you know, I didn't do a final Grammarly check. I just realized I didn't do a final Grammarly check on that. But you know what? It'll be fine. It's book 18. I should get a little grace by now from readers. Yeah. So book is good, and hopefully I'll have the files all uploaded. And if nothing goes hugely wrong over the weekend, I'll have all the files uploaded by Sunday. The EPUB done, Kindle done, hopefully get that all done. And then I can loop back around and start my read-through on book 19. And then we're into the next writing sprint. So, but I'm already at 90,000 words for book 19. And so if that doesn't fall too much through the read-through, then, you know, I'll only have 60,000 words left to go, and I'll have 6 weeks, and then mid-September, I'll launch into the beta build, and then hopefully towards the end of October, I'll be sending out beta books on 19, and then we'll do the whole thing, have everything back in. Mid-August, I should be done with the writing sprint, so that mid-September, I can have the beta books out. Because that gives everybody 6 to 8 weeks. All those beta books come back in November 15th-ish. So then through mid-November through mid-December, work on the beta copy of book 19. Then I have a week off for Christmas before I have to start around and start book 20. Book 20. And then I'll only have 5 to go. So this should be fun. So there was a bit of sadness this week. You know, and it's just one of those things. And it does give you a chance to pause and kind of say, okay, so do we really know what we're doing here? And being the obstinate person that I am, I had to come up with the answer. Yeah, I am. I do know. It has been a fact of my life that there are times that I am misunderstood. I accept that as a fact of my life. And that means either I am deluded according to the masses, or maybe I just have some piece of knowledge that the masses don't have. It has been my practice to assume the former, but I certainly wouldn't be surprised if I got to heaven and found out it was the latter. However, one of the pieces of poetry that I memorized early on, I believe is from a poem called Desiderata, I think. And I had a plaque that it was printed on. I saw it and I thought, oh, that's good. And if I remember the quote correctly, the quote was, if a man does not keep pace with his companion, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer. Let him step to the music he hears, however measured or far away. And I always took a great deal of comfort in that, because I have what could be considered some a little bit different take on life, different take on things, and you know, that has consequences, period. So without going into a great deal of detail, my wife has been working under our pastor's encouragement. My wife has been working to get her license with the district. She had it at one point. She had to give it up because of me, because I was divorced. And it wasn't that I was divorced under conditions that did not apply to my situation, and that did not apply within a larger biblical context. It was easy to justify the divorce through the larger biblical context. But as my wife reminded me this week, she had to give up her license because she was ministering here in Springfield, which is under the Southern Missouri District, but she was credentialed with Oklahoma. And so when she kept trying to get them to talk to her about this situation, Oklahoma didn't want to make the decision. And so they said, well, you're ministering Springfield, so it doesn't have anything to do with us. And she would go to talk to the Southern Missouri District, and they would say, well, you're licensed with the Oklahoma District, so it doesn't have anything to do with us. And they just batted it back and forth to the place that she just said, well, fine. And so she gave up her credentials. So, this whole saga started 6 years ago, but that's neither here nor there. Multiple months ago, she really buckled down and she studied hard, passed all her tests, all that kind of great. last week we went in and had our interview, and they wanted to know about the costumes, and we had a little discussion about that, and you know, well, we heard this week, we had a very nice meeting. We were actually called in for a meeting, had a very nice meeting where the district basically said, we're not going to credential you because of your husband's costumes. Okay, so that's that. Which, this is my sweetie. How's it going, sweetie? Hi. What's up? Oh, so I didn't hit you. Yeah. Well, I'm recording the podcast, so you look like you're doing something fancy. Oh, fun. Fun. Where's the dog? There's the dog. Okay. All right. She's just out gathering wildflowers. So, that's that. And, you know, I have already apologized that my actions led to a point where she couldn't have her credentials. And, you know, I think we're working through that whole situation. But, you know, there you go. Things are what they are. My car feels like it's drifting forward, even though I have it in park. So the costumes are going fine. We have, again, kind of talked about the costumes and done, you know, kind of reflected, but nothing has changed with regard to why I am doing the costumes or what I'm trying to accomplish with the costumes. There isn't really any reason to stop, because my beloved sees what is being accomplished with them, even though perhaps others cannot see it, or perhaps there are some things that are just too far beyond the pale for people to imagine that anything good could be accomplished with that. So that's fine. It was very interesting. It was very, very interesting to go through this process. And it has given me a new perspective on the chances of me being able to communicate much of what I think I know about life, the universe, and everything, specifically with gender relationships, because without going into a great deal of detail, suffice it to say, there wasn't really any desire to understand, and there wasn't really any interest in understanding, and, you know, all I got was blank stares. So that's fine. That's the way that goes. So the good part about that is it has changed my expectation of what might be accomplished in what spheres. Because I have thought for some time, if we could just embrace some of these concepts that I think I've learned about gender differences and gender relationships, that we could actually solve the problem of our men becoming addicted to pornography and our increasing divorce rate, and our children's having babies, and now added to the whole transgender movement that is chewing up our children, by applying some of these principles that I think I have learned, that there might be a pathway forward. What is more clear now is while I will continue to do what I have done, what is more clear now is just it's very, very difficult for many men to arrive at any other understanding than what they have of the nature of life And in fact, they don't really see a need to have any other understanding. And so it's like, okay. I did tell myself this week, one of the interesting things about this is that I feel like I've had some responsibility as a watchman to proclaim what I know, proclaim what I think is valuable. But I've had two experiences now where I have attempted to communicate with people who are in positions of significant leadership, which would have the ability to at least make some of this available to those who serve under them. And in both cases, it's gone in one ear and gone out the other. And so there you go. Anyway, so that's the news from Lake Wobegon there. This week, I came across, I thought it was an interesting little YouTube video. And I didn't know this, and I thought, well, this is fun. And the name of this YouTube video was, why is the at sign on your computer keyboard? Because they started out, you know, the at sign with the little A in the circle. And they started asking that question, and there is this popular story that Ray Tomlinson in 1971 was looking for a way to distinguish between users and hosts, and they were designing a new network electronic mail system. And while this wasn't the first case of sending messages, Ray was the first person to use the at sign, so i.e. user at host.com. And they said some people have made the claim multiple times that the at sign was almost doomed to be cast off because it was used a little, and Tomlinson saved it. But of course, that doesn't explain, as the YouTube video said, why it was on the keyboard in the first place. And it is an interesting thing of how we make the decision of what we keep and how we symbologize and et cetera, et cetera. So the at sign is just an A, and it's just an A with a little circle around it. But what's interesting about it is that you can trace it back a long way. So there's actually a Greek chronicle, a Bulgarian translation of a Greek chronicle written by Constantinos Manassas in 1345. And he ended this paper with the word amen, and the A was a stylized A, which had a circle around it. So then that gets used a little bit more. You know, there's a 1448 letter, and then there was a unit of weight known as arroba. It was designated with a circle letter. And so this at sign with circle around it began to spread in France, where it was originally used in the sense of arroba, or a, was that a measurement of weight, it became to represent the price of something. So as in one bottle of wine at 4 ducats. So now all of a sudden you have this at relationship between two things on either side of it. And so then it becomes commercial, and it goes along, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. In other places, you're into the 1500s now. In other places, it's used to signify point one, or in Italy and Germany, where at was used to represent versus in court cases. So Bob at sign Tom, Bob versus Tom. So what's interesting is Gutenberg Press shows up. And the at sign actually ended up being on a piece of lead. And so at sign does show up in the new typefaces that are on lead. And it also makes its way onto commercial typewriters in the late 1800s. So it's getting fairly established. Not used for a ton of stuff, but fairly established. So even before, the guy says, even before it was standardized to the QWERTY we English speakers know today, QWERTY keyboard, it had already made itself at home, usually sitting on the edge with some other commercial sign like the cent sign. As electrical communications like telegraph and later teletype grew in popularity, so did another phenomenon of the soon-to-be modern world, the need to store and process vast amounts of data. So then you get into taking a census. And they said like the 1880 census took 7 years to count. And so there was a guy named Herman Hollerith who had used punch cards, train conductors using punch cards. And he thought, you know, I could make a tabulating machine that used those things. So he invented the electric tabulating machine, which ran on Hollerith cards, punch cards that hold a form of binary data. And the machine greatly reduced the amount of time needed to complete the 1890 census. He went on to continue to develop his tabulating machines. And in 1911, his company, along with four other similar data processing companies, were amalgamated in New York, forming the new Computing-Tabulating-Recording Company, which later renamed itself in 1924 to the International Business Machines, IBM. So there you go. The thing about it was, IBM had a key coding technique that was called binary coded decimal interchange code, which was abbreviated BCDIC, but the at sign wasn't on it. So now you have the possibility that the at sign is going to die out. And in fact, that goes along and then you get ASCII. Or no. In 1953, what happens is it's expanded to include 8 new characters. And these are taken from teletype keyboards, so you end up with the at sign being included in that character set. And then, you know, the at sign was actually included. Prior to this, the at sign was used to represent a single quote, but then in 1960, it was properly included in the Lisp programming language to perform splice operations. And in 1963, the American Standards Association published their Unified Coding Scheme for the manufacturer, consumer, and general public. This encoding was called the American Standard Code for Information Exchange, or ASCII. And any of you who know anything about computers will immediately recognize that the ASCII code is still used today. And in fact, the at sign was encoded in there. So there you go. All of a sudden, ta-da, the at sign is everywhere. And that's why it was there when Ray Tomlinson went to search for a symbol to put through it. It was already known as at. It was already functioning somewhat as an at. And so there you go. So if it had not been part of ASCII and CBDIC and those things in integral, who know what would have been used by that? Would we have used a dash? Would we have used a period? I mean, how would that have all worked out? But of course, now we just know it as user at host.com. So, you know, it's fun to look back and just see some of these things because it doesn't take too many turns where the future can change. And it's interesting because this last week, Alan, my son-in-law and pastor of our church, preached a sermon on when life goes sideways. And one of the things that he brought out that was really, really interesting was he was talking about the woman of Shunem and the cities that were surrounding that. And the woman of Shunem was the story that was told about Elisha where This woman had made a place in her home on the roof for Elisha to come whenever he was in the area to be fed and to have a place to stay, and had developed quite a relationship. And then he talked to his servant, whose name was Gehazi. And he asked Gehazi, what can we do for her? And he said, well, she doesn't have a child. And so he had her called up and he said, this time next year, you're going to have a child. And she said, don't tease me with this. And so, but that time next year, she has a child. Child grows up to be probably 12 or so. And the child looks like maybe suffered heat stroke or something like that, or possibly had a stroke. Child dies. She gets on a donkey and takes off to find Elijah. Doesn't even tell her husband. And he sends his servant on ahead to put the staff on the child, but nothing happens. And Elijah comes back. And, of course, this is very dramatic, big sideways story, just went sideways. And the child doesn't rouse. And then Elijah comes and he actually physically lays down on the child and breathes and gets up, walks around, physically lays down on the child. And then the child sneezes 7 times, the scripture says. I don't know what that means. And then he's healed and she has her son back. Well, what's really interesting is that apparently she lived in a little town in the vicinity of Shunem. And that town gets renamed to make it easier when you get into Jesus' time to be called Nain. And in fact, when Jesus is in Nain, then a widow's, her son dies, and Jesus raises him from the dead. And Alan was making the point that everybody in that area would know the story of Elisha. They would know the story of the woman of Shunem. They would know the story of her son being raised back to life. And when they saw Jesus raise the widow's son back to life, they would have immediately locked in to say, okay, this guy, whoever he is, actually has the same spirit as the prophet of Elijah. They would lock that together. And Alan's point is in the midst of loss, in the midst of our sorrow, in the midst of things going sideways where we weren't expecting it, you can count on the fact that God is still in control, that God is still working in all those things, and that he will make it right. And it might not happen in your lifetime, but there will be some purpose to it all. And Alan was absolutely right. It was a great message. And we'll just see where all this will lead. But we know for sure that he's good and that he's kind and that he helps us. This is Phil Farrand, and I have made it home.